Red Eye is a program of alternative politics and culture which broadcasts live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM and around the world at cooperadio.org.
On the whole, privatization of education has had to be rebranded to slip through under the radar. Privatization has had to go underground because it turns out that Canadians feel pretty passionately about public education, especially the public part, or at least they do in theory. Unfortunately, privatization has adapted to a hostile environment and figured out how to mutate. It's been able to exploit several depressing converging trends: a culture of consumerism and superficiality, drastic spending cuts, generalized anxiety about the future. But privatization has also, ironically, been able to capitalize on some good things: the great love that people have for their children, at least their own children, if not necessarily other people's children, and the recognition that in a difficult world, education matters more than ever before. It's our challenge to take the positives out of that and work with them. Tonight I want to talk about the many faces and deceptions of privatization, its shape-shifting capacities, and most importantly, to talk about how we strengthen our resistance to its impact. Well, as City TV just asked me out in the hallway, what is privatization exactly? I love doing these interviews, right, with these vast open-ended questions that make you pause. Well, actually, I went back to my really old Webster's Dictionary, which I probably had since high school, and I looked it up the other day, and it actually defines privatization as commercialization, which it then defines as something done mainly for gain or profit. But it also says that commercialization means practicing the spirit of commerce. In other words, privatization means becoming part of the market, but it also means acting like the market or thinking like the market. Well, much as we personify markets, don't you find it interesting to hear, you know, business reporters who are, you know, ubiquitous on television and radio, even on our beloved CBC, talking about the market, and they personify it, right? What will the market do? Or they sympathize with the market far more than, you know, your average person lying on the street. The market had a bad day. It has the flu, the Asian flu, perhaps. How do we make the market happy? They ask this question all the time. You know, cut taxes, cut interest rates? No, raise interest rates. Maybe if we sacrificed a fatted cow. Do we kill Kyoto? Kill ourselves? I mean, what is it that we have to do to satisfy the market? And of course, my favorite, well, this isn't just personification, it's really deification. When you hear them say, the market is always right. I mean, think about it. It's no wonder that Thomas Frank called his book on propaganda, One Market Under God. He argues that when the market gets turned into a belief system instead of a mechanism, by default, we have to accept one of two false ideas. Either that when everyone takes care of themselves, it adds up to everyone taking care of each other, or else that the quality of your life doesn't affect mine. I'm okay, you're irrelevant. Applying the logic of the market to anything of shared importance guarantees that it will not be shared equally. Privatization of other areas of the commons, water, healthcare, our own security, can't proceed unless this truth is disguised, which is why education is such a vital link in the privatization chain. Public education is the target for all kinds of privatization, not just as a component of the marketplace, but especially as a place where the spirit of the market can be taught. Or, she adds hopefully, where it can be challenged. So within this context, I want to talk about four kinds of privatization. Privatization by design, intentional, purposeful, sometimes ideological, often greedy. Privatization by stealth, sneaky forms of privatization that call themselves something else and hope you won't recognize them. Third, privatization by default, the result of real or perceived weakness in the public system. And finally, privatization from the inside out, the kind that happens when privatization looks like the solution, not the problem. This is the kind that's looking for mind share, not just market share. So first, privatization by design. The intentional, concerted effort to undermine public education, either to chip away at the system or gobble up large parts of it whole. Its main players fall into three camps. The ideologues who believe that everything public is mediocre, wasteful, intrusive, and defends the freedom of individuals to do whatever they damn well please. Because they believe that private is always better than public, the evidence be damned, ideologues of this type don't stop at public education, which they tend to call state-run schools. This crowd also likes private health care, private pension schemes, the abolition of unions, small, ineffectual governments, low taxes, and so forth. Privatization as the solution to everything. It's really a pretty uncomplicated worldview when you think about it. Don't you wish you had the one-size-fits-all answer for every problem in your life? And it was the slogan, the old slogan of the Fraser Institute, private sector solutions to public policy problems. One size fits all. But it isn't just ideologues. The private by design crowd also includes folks who just want to get rich. Privateers, we could call them. Now, they may not have a sophisticated understanding of public policy, but they know a business opportunity when they see one. And to them, every dollar not spent in a public school could be spent in a private school, or a service, or other business opportunity, with a tidy profit, of course, going into their pockets. To them, a weakened public education system is just a good climate in which to do business. You know, one that an outfit, say, like Sylvan Learning Systems, can exploit. It's very interesting. Sylvan is quite adroit at marketing to unhappy parents. I was actually doing some Googling and discovering, you know, looking up what was new about Sylvan. Alberta, yeah, I saw some Alberta people here tonight. I understand Sylvan is leasing classrooms in Alberta public schools, empty classrooms. I guess there must not be enough money in Alberta to open and use all those classrooms. So Sylvan's helping out the system, right, by leasing classrooms in order to get close to the customer. And when you think about it, the result of that is the normalization of for-profit tutoring as part of a good, healthy public education system, right? And of course, good, healthy parenting. Do you watch the Sylvan commercials carefully and see how they exploit parental anxiety and the result of using tension is always happiness between you and your teenagers? It's brilliant, really. So groups like those, of course, a weakened public education system is just more opportunities. They absolutely blitzed the airwaves in Ontario in the most recent teacher work job actions in Ontario as the solution to the problem, not of education, of course, of teachers. Anyway, so they are among that group, but there are others as well. Privateers can be part of a consortium of developers just rubbing their hands together at the thought of building P3 schools. I understand British Columbia is taking another look at that model. And I thought your economy was doing so well, I just don't understand. The privateers never cease to remind each other that education is a multi-billion dollar business with, of course, many opportunities for international export. To quote Industry Canada's deathless prose, the education market isn't just for the good times. It's actually what they call counter-cyclical. The worse the economy gets, the more people are prepared to pay for education
because they believe that's the way out for their children. Now, sometimes privateering is subtle, but sometimes it's really obvious. I had to laugh when I saw this item in Wisconsin, one of the states that has had a voucher system for the last 10 years. Confidence in the whole privatization thing was shaken, or at least wobbled a bit, when one of the private voucher schools, Alex's Academy of Excellence, turned out to be run by a convicted rapist. That would be Alex, I guess. Nearby, the Mandela Academy for Science and Math collected $330,000 in state funds for 200 students who apparently never showed up. Several months later, the principal and vice principal were seen driving out of town in new Mercedes. The state, Wisconsin state governor, has refused to bow to pressure to require felony background checks on voucher school staff, although, of course, these are required for public school teachers. But for others in the private by design crowd, motivation comes neither from ideology nor greed, but from theology. Sincere, although in my opinion misguided, individuals, congregations, lobbies, and so forth, see public education as a tool of Satan, and public schools as dens of iniquity that are valueless at best, and at worst, a threat to individual, that would be private, salvation. Have you ever thought of how private the mindset is of fundamentalist Christianity in particular? I mean, it's personal salvation, right? It is my God, not yours, mine, my salvation, you know, my space in heaven that I'm going after. You know, it's not really much of a stretch when you think about it. If you think you are among the select that has the right to your own heaven, it isn't much of a stretch to believe you have the right to your own schools. It really does fit together very neatly. Now, as I'm sure you realize, the influence of what has come to be called the religious right is no longer marginal in the United States, and its influence in Canada remains kind of a black cloud in the horizon that we watch carefully. They get a lot of attention when their issue is getting George W. Bush elected or getting same-sex marriage rejected. But especially in the U.S., the religious right cut its political teeth on public education in ways, I think, that were very much below the radar in Canada and to some extent in the U.S. In one of my books, I think it's No More Teachers, I actually talk about how they influenced the debate over whole language and phonics, which may not be something with which you're familiar, because whole language allowed you to actually interpret and read into text. The reading teachers here will know what I'm talking about in kind of a postmodern way. This was very frightening to those who believe in the literal interpretation of the Bible, and phonics was more suitable to literal readings and interpretations. So in all kinds of ways that we don't understand, the religious right has very much shaped the debates that looked like they're far away from questions such as that. Of course, George Bush rewarded and will continue to reward the religious right by funding, for example, religion-based social services in the U.S., a likely reversal of Roe v. Wade, reinstituting prayer in schools, a challenge to any curriculum that isn't religion-based, and so forth. And, of course, it wasn't just George W. Bush. His education czar, and in the first term, Rod Paige, often said that if he had his way, every child in America would be attending a private school. Now, that characterized the last administration, and of course will be continued in the next one. Now, it isn't just Republicans. The American legislation that entrenches privatization, called No Child Left Behind, NCLB, was endorsed by John Kerry as well as George Bush. Now, ultra-right-wing think tanks, American think tanks, or maybe now we should be calling them American mainstream think tanks, like the Reason Foundation, are absolutely delighted with No Child Left Behind. because of the direct benefits to private charter and voucher schools. And it's pretty clear on their website as they track the increased encroachment of private schools as a direct result of No Child Left Behind. And of course others, the tutoring corporations and the technology corporations, are happy as well. It's really, the linkage here is really interesting among those three groups of intentional privatizers that I've described. Because of the religious rights zeal and tireless and well-organized and extremely well-funded lobbying efforts, the religious lobby is often used as the mouthpiece, as the folks out front for the privateers and the ideologues as well. The recent and unsuccessful Ontario legislation, which would have given direct tax credits to parents of children putting their parents of children to be enrolled in private schools, something that went way further than voucher schools, actually. It was defeated, but it was presented and argued as if it was an issue of freedom of religion, when in fact, in the background, the ideologues and the privateers, those who wanted to get into the for-profit private school business, would benefit just as much. This conservative alliance, the ideologues, the privateers, the theologues, which Marty and I actually predicted in class warfare, has shown an ability to cooperate very effectively. This raises the question, of course, of whether we have done our work in creating an equally effective progressive alliance to deal with the conservative alliance, to turn back their influence. And that question is in front of us, whether the issue is public education or energy policy or human rights and same-sex marriage. Because the Conservative Alliance pushes all governments, whether or not their stated political ideology is explicitly pro-privatization, to shrink government, to reduce spending in ways that will have the greatest political gain at the smallest political cost. That's the way politics works. Education is an attractive target because of its size, obviously, in provincial budgets, but also because, as you'll see, quite a lot of it can be accomplished through stealth. Certainly, with very few exceptions, no provincial governments have been elected because they campaigned on how great it would be to privatize schools. In fact, a lot of politicians who denied it, but still had a kind of ode to privatization about them, were defeated. But I'm not entirely sure how central education policy has been in the election or defeat of provincial governments across the country. I'm not sure that it's been the deciding issues. But still, public opinion has not driven any of the education reforms, as we call them, of the last decade. I haven't heard any massive outcry to make class sizes larger, or to hallways dirtier, or to increase the dropout rate, or to shorten the school week. None to drive out good teachers. Governments weigh the political gains and losses in terms of public opinion, but also the intensity of public opinion. I was quite pleased when I attended one conference of privateers, the for-profit guys talking about the education marketplace, and there was an American there from one of the big investment houses who was explaining why his really bullish predictions of the previous year hadn't quite come to pass. And he said, well, we could have got a lot further if it was just up to governments. He said, but you know, it was so frustrating. All those middle-aged women marching around public schools, holding their signs up, save our schools. He said, around our office, we call them the bitchalantes. And I thought, a job description, I finally have one. So it's not just this soft opinion, but the intensity of opinion that governments are looking at. We've done some really good work on maintaining the regard the public has for our schools and mobilizing people to resist cuts. But I'm not always sure that we've developed a public appetite for better schools, a public sense of what a really great public education system would look like 10 years from now. We've drawn some lines, but we haven't provided the vision, something that governments can use and sell to the public as a political winner. Somebody told me a story last week that he had gone to, as a parent, to a school meeting. This is in Ontario, billed as some kind of, you know, consultation on public education. He said the president of every conceivable interest group was there, and the minister of education, and two parents, even though it was a parent meeting. Now, in Ontario, the Liberal government in the last year has put another $500 million into education. According to my friend, one after another, the interest group stood up and just gave the minister shit. One after another. And he sat there and he thought, you know, $500 million doesn't get you much credit anymore, does it? And I thought, you know, and his comment was, this was strategically really dumb. Because what you're forcing that minister to do is say, would I have got more credit if I had cut $500 million from the budget? Would it have been more of a political winner? Strategically, we have to reward and give political incentives to governments who are willing to go out on a limb for public education. I am no apologist for the Liberal government in Ontario or any other government, and there's much to hold them accountable for. But if we want public by design, not private by design, we have to incorporate vision and reward as well as critique and punishment into our strategies. So, from privatization by design to privatization by stealth. Earlier I said that privatization includes being part of the market, acting like the market, and or thinking like the market. Privatization by stealth, to me, is part of acting like the market. The core characteristic of markets is competition. Competition to gain the most for the least. So, in effect, picking a stock that's going to go up, buying it cheap, is really the same as choosing where you will get your slave labor to produce your manufactured good. It's really exactly the same logic. Getting the most for the least in today's jargon is called productivity, a focus on outcomes. To be productive, you invest in winners and get rid of losers. Closing a Walmart in Jonquière follows exactly the same logic as closing 131 schools in British Columbia. The same inexorable logic and gravity of the market. Business management books will tell you that if you want to succeed as a business, you have to measure more, increase standardization, and enforce quality control, especially quality control of your workforce. This has meant that professional accountability, which for me has always meant taking responsibility for good choices and good judgment, has been deformed into a definition of accountability that means teachers are able to prove they did what they were told to do. There's a huge difference in those two types of accountability. The centralization of curricula, the standardization of evaluation and reporting, efforts to enforce teacher quality control by pre-service or in-service certification or through technology, the general loss of teacher autonomy, these are all absolutely predictable results of treating education as a market. Businesses are expected to find their niche. School choice is a business model because it gives you a niche, a chance to distinguish yourself from the competition and demonstrate your superiority. Now, as I see it, whole segments of the public education system have been demonstrating that they can act like the market too. Even though they're ostensibly public, they're really good because they've taken on all the core characteristics of the private system. Schools increasingly compete with each other for students because public systems have decided that they will create boutique schools to appeal to niche markets, whether that's international baccalaureate programs or French immersion and so forth. Target schools, as they're called. Niche markets always appeal to the high end because of the desire to separate the winners from the losers, the role of competition. Schools and school systems compete with each other for enrollment, for partnerships with corporations, for foreign students, in fundraising, and of course, in student achievement. Here, the most important marketing tool is standardized testing, of course. I am resisting the temptation to launch you to another speech called 27 Ways the Standardized Testing Leads to Privatization, but if you want to stay another couple of hours, I would be more than happy to give it. But okay, I'll skip to the conclusion. Standardized testing forces both private and public schools to value some kinds of students, some kinds of customers, more than others. The kids who are the easiest to teach, who perform well on tests, whose parents are really involved, who don't have any special needs, well, maybe they're allowed to be gifted. These kids on the A team become highly desirable because they make a big contribution to the school's bottom line. Test scores. It can't be any other way. The kids who need schools the most, the ones who will never make the A list, will always be considered liabilities in a market model. They drive down the school's test scores. They drive away new customers towards other businesses. Inevitably, the distance increases between what are seen as good schools and bad schools within the system. The quality of the teachers follows. That's true in public systems, it's true in private systems. Now, you can kind of discourage or reinforce this tendency. I don't think you can eliminate it. It's been reinforced in many American states where schools, principals, and individual teachers are rewarded and paid based on the school's test scores. Schools performing poorly, which are predictably teaching the neediest kids, who have the most demand coming from those kids, are penalized financially, fined. While the schools doing well get extra funding, and their teachers and students get big bonuses, thus attracting more of the same kind of teachers. I mean, it is absolutely logical inside that illogical framework of the market. No, we aren't there yet. But if you think of the laws of market gravity, what's just a little further downstream? Just because something is unthinkable doesn't make it unlikely. Other kinds of privatization by stealth include partnerships. Now, on this subject, I thought that former Prime Minister Jean Chrétien's comments at the Gomery Commission were quite perfect. He was asked exactly when sponsorships were introduced. And you know, Jean kind of scratched his head and said, well, he really wasn't sure, because the same stuff used to be called advertising. But then they started calling it sponsorships. And, quote, I guess it sounded better, he said. Bien sûr, Jean. Corporations like soft advertising, and associations with children and schools are warm and fuzzy. They slip under the radar. They're advertising without looking like advertising. They provide great social marketing opportunities. And don't forget a tax write-off. The duplicity is absolutely astounding. One arm of the corporation sits around with the big boys at the Council of Chief Executive Officers, what used to be called, you know, the Business Council on National Issues, and they're there demanding tax cuts, more privatization, harmonization with the U.S., and lower standards of public services. While the other arm of the same corporation, the philanthropic one, tries to launder the corporation's image through partnerships with schools. I mean, Walmart is the perfect example. It's not just Walmart. I note that Bill Gates personally contributed $3 million to try to get a charter schools initiative approved by referendum in November. No hidden agenda there, right? One of the aspects of this dynamic that interests me the most is how frequently schools adopt the language, values, and practices of their corporate partners, and the kind of unconsciousness this requires. I mean, the stories really go on forever. The school principal in Manitoba, who over the phone told me that, you know, yes, IBM was training his teachers, and I asked, what is this corporation training your teachers to do? And he said, oh, I don't think of IBM as a corporation. They're just our friends. IBM Incorporation. You know, the principal who handed out a free Coke t-shirt to his kindergarten class because he thought it was cute for each of them to be wearing, you know, a sign that said, I'm the real thing. Teacher who told me proudly that the culture of his school had changed, that now they had a partnership. His school had a business plan, they said. They dropped education words from their vocabulary, and they were all reading the newest business bestseller for professional development. Privatization by stealth. How about parent fundraising? Teachers paying for supplies out of their pockets. I really think we should stop calling it fundraising and name the problem, as they say. What should we call it? Tolls? Head tax, maybe? Deterrent fees? Or somebody suggested the other day, I like this, we can call it the B3 education funding model. Begging, bingos, and bottle drives. Now, this leads me to the next type of privatization, privatization by default. Or maybe we should call it privatization by denial. Privatization by default happens when circumstances converge to weaken public education to the point that it can no longer live up to its goals or is perceived as no longer valuable. Here, privatization succeeds not on its own merits, but because public education is seen as a failed experiment. So there is no alternative but to privatize. Now here I think the parallel with healthcare is really useful. Those in favor of a privatized healthcare system no longer outright condemn Medicare. They just say mournfully that it isn't working. And therefore we have no choice but to allow more room for private healthcare. I mean, it sounds kind of familiar, doesn't it? There's an interesting indicator that this has actually been a very successful strategy. When pollsters ask the public about the general state of healthcare in Canada, typically people respond that it's in really bad shape. Oh my God, people are dying all over for lack of care or lack of hospital space. You know, they're dying in the corridors, they're waiting forever for really urgent tests. But when you ask them about their own experiences with the healthcare system, the same people report that actually they had pretty prompt care, very caring, very competent. They explain that discrepancy between their own experience and this view of the whole system as sort of winning a lottery. They just got lucky. The marketing message that Medicare is failing has trumped people's own experience with the system. And the same is true of education. People who have direct experience with schools rate their quality much higher than those who are far away from schools. But just like people who had a hip replacement, parents who have more than a decade of experience with good schools still think they just got lucky. Now that's a real challenge because as the population shifts and fewer people have direct contact with schools because a smaller percentage of the population are parents, it increases the size of the population that is getting their information about the quality of schools from another source, say something neutral like the Vancouver Sun. But directly discrediting public education in the way that the National Post and the Economic Council of Canada and several premiers and, of course, the Fraser Institute, the way they did in the 1990s has actually fallen out of favor in most circles. It's become more subtle, but no less intentional. After a recent national public opinion poll on education, Helen Rahan, a name well known to you, of course, was asked by the National Post to explain why parents in Manitoba and Saskatchewan were substantially more positive about school quality than respondents in the rest of the country. Well, she said, that's because the Fraser Institute hasn't got around to ranking schools in those provinces yet. That was very interesting, very revealing. I mean, obviously, despite what the Fraser says about it's just providing parents with information, its real agenda is to encourage hostility, build dissatisfaction, and defame public education. Because it really doesn't matter how much the public loves the idea of public education in theory. If Canadians believe schools have deteriorated to the point that they can't be fixed, we'll have privatization by default. Unfortunately, it is easier to make schools worse rather than better. Cutting funding is the fastest way, of course, because the quality of our system depends so much on having the resources to make them effective. But on the other hand, the same thing can be accomplished by simply redefining what schools are supposed to be doing, measuring them against unattainable goals. Now here, the No Child Left Behind Act is kind of instructive. It requires every school in the United States, every school, to demonstrate progress towards perfection. That is, unless every single child can demonstrate proficiency in every single domain by the year 2014, the school will have been judged to have failed, and therefore right to be turned over to the private sector. It's part of the legislation. Now, by this standard, some states now report that 80% of their schools are failing, and some are being gradually turned over to the private sector for remediation and rescue. I mean, there are many ways for schools to fail. You can have unattainable expectations, or unreasonable ones, or just completely contradictory ones. Schools can be seen as failures if they're held responsible for keeping struggling kids in school, but not given the flexibility to modify curricula to meet their needs. On the one hand, to be told, you know, we have to teach all kids, but give them all the same test. Schools can be seen as failures if obesity rates are too high, if graduation rates are too high or too low. Think about it. Either way, schools are at fault. They can even be found guilty and judged to be failures if they allow lippy kids to disrespect the Governor General, or if they discipline the lippy kid for disrespecting the Governor General. You really can't win. But there's another source of privatization by default that's even more difficult to address. As I said, I was Googling Sylvan, looking for a really good corporate profile, which I didn't find. But Sylvan stocks are down, you'll be happy to know. When, kind of accidentally, I ran across this article in Today's Parent magazine. I don't know if you know the magazine's Canadian, you know, good stuff for parents. Absolutely non-ideological. Just a nice Canadian magazine. And in it, there's an article about tutoring. You know, tutoring, is it worth it? That kind of headline. Among the parents interviewed in it, there's one with a British Columbia parent who has enrolled all three of his high-achieving children in a Sylvan program after school. According to the article, Spiro, that's the dad, says he has no problem paying $300 a month to Sylvan if it means that his three-year-old will do better than her peers. Quote, it's very competitive out there, he says. I think if children start at an early age, they get accustomed to a certain stress level. They develop good routines, and that gives them an edge over their peers. Now, Spiro will see public education as a failure so long as it resists the idea that stress is a desirable part of life for three-year-olds. Can public education ever make this parent happy without selling its soul? So, do we have a problem with saboteurs, a quality problem, or a public relations problem? Maybe a cultural problem. Maybe schools are just out of touch with the privatized values of their communities. I think, frankly, it's some of each. I think we're naive if we expect the good work of schools to speak for itself, or to expect the corporate media to shower attention on us for our accomplishments. We do far too little to boast about our successes. Let me give you just one example. As you probably know, not only have our results on international tests been quite remarkable, I mean, we routinely now score third or fourth, depending on the size of the crowd, in tests of math and science. And this despite the incredible diversity of our system and the diversity of the kids in it. We as a country, have the smallest gap between the typical performance of low-income students and high-income students. In a couple of provinces, we have the smallest measured gap in the world. My concern, of course, is that there aren't nearly enough people out there applauding because they don't know this story. And it's partly our fault. A couple of years ago, for a Phi Delta Kappa column, I crunched some numbers provided by Stats Canada that found that according to five separate measures of the link between socioeconomic status and math scores, it appeared that in Saskatchewan, family income no longer showed any statistically significant impact on math performance among 15-year-olds. That is an absolutely astonishing finding. But it wasn't teachers and administrators who trumpeted the results, STF, even though I provided the document to you, and I thought it had gone into thin air, just been printed in the United States. That's really helpful. I did actually discover that it was read into Hansard by the Minister of Education in Saskatchewan. But God, I wish it had been teachers who had taken the credit. Right across the country, not just in Saskatchewan, our equity gap is really remarkably small, much smaller than in the United States. It's one of our advantages. Smaller than that in the countries that occasionally outperform us. But here's another example. Maybe you've done it, and I haven't seen it, but I haven't seen teachers trumpet the resort of the recent thorough, exhaustive, and exhausting report by the highly respected Douglas Wilms from the University of New Brunswick, who again, using Stats Canada data, crunched the numbers to say once you have accounted for the impact of income in Canada, students in private schools in Canada do not outperform students in public schools in Canada. That's really quite remarkable, considering we have a smaller private education system that to a large extent is geared to a very elite, or at least presents itself as a very elite model. It's really a remarkable accomplishment given the boutique nature of most of those private schools, which actually reminds me of being in my dentist's chair last week. I've gone to the same dentist for a long time, from when she was pregnant, and now she has two children, grade 5 and 7, elementary school. And I asked her just before all the things went into my mouth, what's up? And for the next half hour, she told me all about how she realized she had made the worst decision ever since she bought stock in Nortel. She has had her two children in a very elite Ottawa private school for all these years. She had worried from time to time that they weren't doing very well, and the school had always told her she was just one of those mothers, right? Not to worry, everything was fine. It was such a wonderful school, how could anything be wrong? She had them privately tested and discovered they're years and years behind in pretty well all the basic skills. And what did I think of the fact that her private school had told her that if her kids were going to remain there for the privilege of paying $12,000 a year tuition, she would have to promise to get them Sylvan tutoring 3 days a week. Now, I wasn't able, because her fingers were in my mouth, to tell her exactly what I thought. In fact, if her fingers hadn't been in my mouth for most of our, 15-year relationship, she would never have had them in private school in the first place. But selling the private school advantage, of course, if Barbara had known what Doug Wilms knows about private schools, she would have put her children in public schools right at the beginning and not just last week. They're very happy there, apparently. Now, at the same time, I think we do have some problems of quality in public education. I think that our schools are doing remarkably well under the circumstances. But regrettably, the examples I just gave of success are measuring a very narrow band of what it is public education is all about. And like you, I have questions about the validity and the reliability of those tests. And this is a dilemma. Do we use the results of something that is flawed and quite possibly destructive to claim that we're doing a good job? It is a dilemma. To a large degree, we haven't resolved this issue, so we're just kind of mumbling instead, as we mumble quietly about other problems. Just thinking about that. When I think back to the leadership shown by teachers in criticizing their own system, in the reforms that that brought around issues of gender, around issues of race, around issues of equity, it was teachers criticizing our own practice that made those tremendous transformations of the 1970s and 1980s. Yes, we are still criticizing, but increasingly we are criticizing the other of those things imposed on us, of those things taken away from us. And there's legitimate complaint. But I don't get the sense that we are contributing much to a critique to creating the idea of the public system of the future by critiquing our own ability to improve what it is we do, even under within the circumstances that I just described. And this makes us vulnerable to a fourth kind of privatization. Privatization from the inside out, I call it. Because it isn't just about market share, it's about mind share too. Mind share, not just for products, but for ideas. Some of you might have seen a recent poll reported the other day by CNN that asked 10,000 American high school students what they thought of the First Amendment to the American Constitution. That's the one intended to guarantee freedom of religion, of speech, press, and assembly. According to this poll, when shown its actual wording, a full third of American high school seniors thought that the First Amendment went too far. It was way too liberal. Less than half of the students, and this was a sample of 10,000, less than half of the students thought the newspapers should be allowed to publish material not approved by government. I can only think that in class they've learned more about you're with us or you're against us than they did about the Constitution. So where do you learn about citizenship? Other presentations and workshops this weekend will talk a lot about marketing to children through schools, the impact of the media. One of the best examples of going after mind share and market share simultaneously. So there's lots to blame corporations for. But when I was doing the research for No More Teachers, No More Books, I kept running into anomalies I couldn't blame entirely on marketers, the privateers. Like the guy who wrote the math textbook for grade fives that was full of products, you know, dividing Oreo cookies, multiplying the day's profit at Walmart and, you know, buying new Nikes and so on. Now, the author, when he was criticized, pointed out that he didn't receive a cent for all the publicity he was giving these corporations. He just wanted to give kids something that they could relate to, something they thought was important. Or how about this? One of the schools my children attended in nice suburban Ottawa launched a whole school project on excellence. It was announced in the newspaper. Whole school project on excellence that was, wait for it, designed and sold by the Church of Scientology. No teacher in that school, or to my knowledge in the system, no parent other than I expressed any concerns. Or I think of the kid who called into a talk show I was doing about commercialism in the classroom, and he phoned in and he said, "Well, miss, I don't get your point. I went to a Coke high school. Yeah, but now I'm in a Pepsi university, so it all evened out. What's your problem?" And for a moment, on air. So do I blame Pepsi or Coke for colonizing his brain? And who do I blame for this story? I ran across a story in the newspaper about an Ontario decision to add something called money management to the high school curriculum. A few hours of forensic Googling later, I had pieced together a story that led from Canwest Global through the Toronto Stock Exchange, through the Harris government, and into the classroom. The curriculum in question, which became part of the compulsory Grade 10 Ontario curriculum, and which has since been exported across the country, I understand, was a thinly veiled combination of privatization propaganda and marketing for the stock exchange. Students were taught explicitly, because it was stated in the turnkey lesson plans that were provided, the script said that in the future, all Canadian healthcare would be private, there would be no more public pensions, and everyone would pay for their own education. The solution, of course, was to start investing early in the stock market. Yes, indeedy, it is public education's job to make sure each kid learns about the relative merits of strip bonds and derivatives. But not just that, to believe the worldview, the ideology of privatization. But whose minds are the target? Would someone please explain to me exactly what the project's advisory board was thinking? I know what the Toronto Stock Exchange was thinking. But what about the advisory board, made up of teachers, superintendents, directors, principals, professors, teacher organization representatives, and one well-known professor and author with national name recognition for her outstanding work on anti-racist and inclusive education? What were they thinking? In effect, by producing and promoting this curriculum, these education professionals performed money laundering for the Toronto Stock Exchange. Money laundering for privatization, and nobody peeped. Who is to blame? Who are the idiots? Well, let me close by talking about idiocy. Here I'm borrowing from a really neat article by Walter Parker in the most recent Phi Delta Kappan, and he calls it Teaching Against Idiocy. Parker reminds people that the root word of idiot is the Greek idios, which means private, separate, self-centered, selfish, in other words. So the ancient Greeks, to the ancient Greeks, idiotic behavior consisted of acting as if only private interest mattered, that one's well-being is independent of common interest. Again, in Greek, the word politis means citizen or public, the realm that the idiot dismisses or ignores. Now, today the term idiot has come to mean stupid, precisely because to Greek philosophers it was almost suicidally stupid to believe that self-interest could be advanced without a strong public common realm. The Greeks thought of idiots as deeply immature. They called the process of growing up, of making the transition from idiot to citizen, puberty. Funny, isn't it, that we no longer associate puberty with the process of leaving self-centeredness of childhood for the common-centeredness, the consciousness of citizenship. You know, instead we think of puberty as when you start getting interested in Britney Spears. But in fact, puberty is marked by an appreciation of our independence, interdependence. When the market becomes our only way of relating to each other, we are choosing a system that guarantees our perpetual idiocy. When we apply the market to schools, we violate our responsibility for puberty, for giving guiding our students from the idiocy of self-interest to the wisdom of public citizenship. This is something that privatization, whether by intent, stealth, default, or idiocy, cannot achieve. I believe we have to challenge the privatization of schools by building the publicization of schools. We must devote our public schools more explicitly to to helping our students and each other reach the maturity of public citizenship. For unless we do that, unless we do that job well, our short-term successes in stemming the privatization of schools won't survive into the next generation. And once schools are lost, it won't matter if it's by design or default. But if we do it well, we will have safeguarded not just public education, but all the commons. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Red Eye, a program produced by an alternative media collective in Vancouver, Canada. Red Eye broadcasts live every Saturday morning from 9 until noon and can be heard around the world at cooperadio.org.